Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about...
This is episode 5 of me reading through the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy on Gottlieb Leibniz, 1646 to 1716. So that's, you know, way before, or before the French Revolution. You've got the emergence of key figures like Newton. I suppose he predates Kant just a little bit, and Descartes, all those important people swirling about the place. Much criticized, but when you actually look at it, so he has sort of gone back to the ancients, read the ancients' theory of monads, and has drawn that through, adding monads plus God must exist, puts those two together, and gets this incredibly complex world, where things are infinitely complex. So you go down even sub-infinite, you're allowed to go down an infinite level of detail of things, and there's an infinite amount of knowledge and information in everything. At every point in time, every point has the entire information of the universe with it. So, as a quantum physicist, you know, there's some quantum statements which, oh, well, that's not how it is in an experiment. Oh no, we've found out something different from that. So we're actually getting experimental evidence, to do it, and I suppose this idea would never be able to look through it. The interesting thing is, before you just join the crowds of people poo-pooing the guy, this is actually what the majority of teachers actually believe. They believe that you can actually go down infinitely. Once you go down to an electron, you can go down to the surface of an electron. You can stand on the surface of an electron. You can dig out a little surface of the planet, and you can keep on going down infinitely and infinitely small. I remember as a kid, 4 years old, having this dream or idea that you can keep on going down in scales of worlds, and they'd be exactly the same but smaller scale. And this is actually a belief held by many people teaching science today. This idea that there's no minimum scale that you can go down to. And in fact, eerily, they draw on the boards when explaining things. They use a lot of the words of Leibniz and actually use a lot of the symbols of Leibniz. I would argue that Pythagoras' first circle in the sand that he drew with a dot in the center is eerily like an atom, the drawing of an atom, and a lot of the concepts of that on top, that the monad is supposed to be a symbol of irreducible smallness, but people then go into looking at a monad within a monad, which is what Leibniz eventually did. And it's interesting that there's no boundaries to make him stop in either direction, I suppose. There's nothing to actually criticize him, he was subjected to letters. People, it was at a time where intellects were sufficiently dispersed, and they're not on the internet, they're not necessarily publishing full on, so they can actually develop their full ideas. And essentially, this is, as far as I can see, the last gasp. Well, is it the last gasp of scholasticism? So scholasticism is the idea of Sir Thomas Aquinas, where you've got books which God has actually said, that book's correct. And this one over here is correct. And you get the two books together. While you're reading those two books, oh, God has said they're both correct. How would you think? They're contradicting. That must be way of God's telling me there's knowledge scholasticism. And scholasticism necessarily meant that you had to exhaustively go through texts, and it meant that he had this scholasticism in his own work. He exhaustively went through his own thoughts, and whereas today you'll spend a few years in a certain area of philosophy, Monday will run out of that. You'll be contracts for doing something else. You'll move on. You'll have a memory of it, but this isn't here. Before I start reading, which is 6 section 6, epistemology, which I really must admit I don't quite know. I think epistemology is a theory of religion. I'm not quite sure on that one. Unfortunately, you're getting me as a computer scientist and robotic scientist reading through this and seeing, oh, there's a bit of set theory there. Oh, that's a little bit of a tilt at quantum mechanics. Oh, there's some information. Essentially, Leibniz is talking about information theory. It's really interesting. It's interesting for me to see people who aren't skilled in the art of that, or aren't skilled in education, or like they assume that you automatically understand monadism and you understand what Descartes and all these other people say. It's interesting to see that. As you go through, I'll just summarise what we're up to at the moment. We've had the Leibniz on the world stage, Leibniz's life, Leibniz's basic machinery. He had a machinery of four concepts or principles that he used, and he used that to, in the fourth section, look at what is a substance, what is being, and then from what's being, what is a person, what's an animal, what's a soul, and stuff like that. And we're up to, that's five, we're up to six to go through. Before I start reading, I should do an advertisement that this podcasting has a natural limit. The feed system is just not up to it. It's got certain things that it's easy to distribute, but I'll point you to and advertise you to the new generation of apps, which indeed uses a certain sort of maths to allow a computer to assemble an app from a series of podcasts. And yesterday afternoon I taught it to read a tile and from that convert to produce another tile. So a tile is like an icon on a mobile phone. It's like that. And then this morning stepped back, converted that to the general principle of doing that so I could feed it a table of tiles to produce. And I'm coming back to thinking, so the table now says for the individual podcast is MP3. Another tile will come up next to MP4. And I've just set it up and ready to take the quiz and the word jumble as buttons on your mobile phone to actually click through. This is one of the things that I've put in the resources in the blog interface. First, the blogs are fighting me, which is, you know, I could fight against it, but at the end, people aren't acclimatized to calling up resources when they listen for a podcast. They just want to listen to a podcast. They don't want to do anything else. And the actual audience isn't there. So long term, there has to be a solution of sort of looking at getting through podcasts. And I've sort of been, my wings have been clipped a little bit, in that, I'm doing a series of podcasts, and there are these classic podcasts people have tends to be interested in. Some of them surprise me. Like there's a long-term interest in electronic configuration, which is almost an out-of-date subject. So there are these podcasts, and you can't search them in the feed. People are looking at them. And the actual paying money to people to advertise your feed and stuff like that. It's something about trying to catch an audience at the moment. I suppose what I can see is that I've got a long-term project to possibly develop a new type of audience, which is also sophisticated, can actually think of a whole series of apps or a whole series of work, a person's work, as structured in an app. And so this is very similar to Leibniz, which is he's producing a large amount of stuff and it's in a library. Essentially, he's not producing a central work, he's producing a series of papers and books, and it's a bit like a distributed app. There is a Leibniz app out there. It takes the time to work it out, and we're here many years afterwards working out exactly what he's doing. And the sort of shock is that although he's consigned to the history of an important step, but no longer a relevant step. But his method of teaching, his thinking, is a very natural way of going through if you're uneducated. And unfortunately, or fortunately, or interestingly, that's the idea in many teachers. Say, if you sat down a science teacher and asked them about an electron, about a neutron and a proton and stuff like that, all the way down, they would tell you that it's got a surface and you can land on the surface of it, and sort of surface, but you can land on the surface of it. And they'd have this idea of infinite complexity, which they try and teach their kids, which is the infinite complexity of Leibniz, and they'd actually draw on the board an atom, which is a dot and a circle around the outside, which just happens to be the pattern of a monad. And so it's interesting that we've got a bit of a task ahead of us, because Leibniz is alive and well, and he's not a bad guy, but Leibniz mistakes is what's been taught in schools at the moment. So getting on to, now I have to get up to an hour reading, or 15 minutes reading through, so how we go. That means that I churn through this pretty quickly. It seems very obvious I really have to do Pythagoras. I'll do one on Pythagoras. I must admit, these leave me flat a little bit, because it's not transdisciplinary. This is someone who's very much in the philosophy discipline. So they're not bringing in physics, which has got a certain amount of philosophy, and maths. It's very interesting that maths is central to Pythagoras, definitely to Nicholas de Cusa, Kant. And when you look at the way Leibniz's writing is there, Descartes as well, it's all this fundamental idea that maths and exploration of God is also the exploration of the infinite. And really, maths is outside as the social laws. Like a social law is possession, you know, I own something. It's a fundamental social law. And so is religion, so there's a big overlap here in the machinery that they use, and eventually religion for them is, or Leibniz, is a big exercise in set theory and infinite, and he's actually come up with that God is part of an infinite set, and the infinite sets are uncountable. Yeah, they're relatable but uncountable. Let's go forward. Epistemology 6. Leibniz's reflection on epistemological matters do not rival his reflections on logic, metaphysics, divine justice, natural philosophy in terms of quantity. Nevertheless, he did think deeply about the possibility and the nature of human knowledge, and his main doctrines will be presented here. So epistemology is the theory of knowledge. God, it's not a theory of religion. Gee, well, this is part of me rehabbing, just really rebooting. And I'm pleased to say that I am rebooting. I'm beginning to remember other things. So we'll find out whether I've got degenerative brain damage or it's just been a shock. I'll find that out in the next month or so. But I may as well just keep on punching away. 6.1, Meditations on Knowledge, Truth and Ideas. In 1684, Leibniz published a short treatise with the above title, which is epistemology, which is theory of knowledge. It was the first mature publication, and one which is often referred to in the courses of his philosophical, he often referred to in the courses of his philosophical career. Leibniz sets out a series of distinctions for human knowledge or cognition, knowledge as either obscure or clear. Clear knowledge is either confused or distinct. Distinct knowledge is either inadequate or adequate. Adequate knowledge is either symbolic or intuitive. Bloody hell, that's a tree diagram, isn't it? I don't know why we don't get a tree diagram in front of us here. Whereas I, for my epistemology, I have there's sort of different, sort of very much social grades of knowledge. So there's conventional knowledge, like the days of the week. There's knowledge which has got social value to climb up places. So if you know something, you've got a value of it, like the knowledge that you have as a doctor or something like that. So we can attribute it. So we can sort of label that your pool of knowledge and put a quality to it. And then there's a fourth thing, a higher knowledge, which is actually self-referential, your epistemology to go through it. And of course, the actual, functional knowledge. I wish I could go into it. I had written something up, not a tree diagram. There you go. As a computer scientist, you'd say, reading that tree diagram. Now, according to Leibniz, clear knowledge means being able to recognize something that is represented to us. For example, a rose. This is knowledge that is both clear and distinct. When one can enumerate marks sufficient to distinguish a rose from other things, which is basically his knowledge theory. When one gives such an enumeration, one possesses a distinct notion of a concept and thus able to give nominal definition to a thing, which is very similar to what my belief is, your nominal social knowledge thing. Further, if all marks that form, which is really rather interesting because people are very interested, or people with limited knowledge are interested in developing a kid's nominal knowledge, but don't, or nominal intelligence, but doesn't necessarily their creative or disruptive intelligence. I suppose there's conformative intelligence and disruptive intelligence. I would actually argue that there's two forms of intelligence. And there's front intelligence that you're aware of, and background burn intelligence where you're unaware of it and things just fall into your lap. Further, if all the marks that form part of a distinct notion are themselves distinctly known, then the cognition is adequate. And finally, if the notion is complex and we are able to consider all of its components and notions simultaneously, then our knowledge is intuitive. Ultimately, Leibniz holds that human beings have intuitive knowledge only of primary notions and proposition, whereas God, of course, has intuitive knowledge of all things. Actually, quite insightful, isn't it? That's what I would also agree with Leibniz. I wouldn't say about the God bit, but we've got that complete knowledge set, which, rather than the physical world, his knowledge system refers to thought. Leibniz believes his distinctions also serve to show the difference between true and false ideas. An idea is true, he writes, when the notion possible is possible, and the false when it includes a contradiction. Now, possibly, a possibility that is established a priori and a posteriori. Possibility can before or after. On one hand, we can know a priori before it happens that something is possible if we resolve it into its components of notions that are themselves possible, and if we know that there is no incompatibility amongst the component notions. On the other hand, we know a posteriori that something is possible merely through experience, or the actual existence of a thing, a proof of possibility, which is really interesting because quantum mechanics is all about statistics and statistical mechanics, which sort of, I suppose, limits the way he would be able to think about things. 6.2, truth of reasons and truth of facts. While Leibniz's principle of contradiction and principle of sufficient reason were discussed above, it is not mentioned that these two principles are employed in the service of Leibniz's distinction between the truths of reasoning and the truths of facts. That is, when necessary truths and continued truths. Now, this is absolutely fascinating. Okay, I should mention with the maths that are in the this stuff. Leibniz, the app, these podcasts are contained in an app universe where you can go through. Leibniz's account of modality is treated elsewhere, but short But a short account of this distinction is here required. In the case of truth of reasoning, its reason or explanation can be discovered by analysis of the notion or concepts, resolving into simpler ideas and simpler truths until we reach primitives. Ultimately, all truths of reason is resolvable into primitives or identities. Principle of contradiction is thereby operative. In the case of truth of facts, on the other hand, its reason cannot be discovered through a finite process of analysis or resolution of notions. However, there must be a reason that some particular fact is or not otherwise, and, according to Leibniz, the reason is found outside a series of contingent things. I just find it interesting, if you actually look into the maths of this app that I've got you using, perhaps. And, of course, we've got Schrodinger's cat, which is would just blow his mind. It is interesting in that people without the philosophical knowledge, I suppose, stop reasoning when they're told it's magic. It's amazing. Okay, 6.3, innate ideas. And we're 21 minutes in. Leibniz is often put in the camp of rationalists as opposed to empiricists. For example, Lockley, Berkeley, and Hume. I have to look at who Berkeley is and do something about it. And while there are good grounds to be unhappy with this standard textbook distinction, Leibniz does not fit the bill in two important aspects. He is a rationalist insofar that he holds the principle of sufficient reason. He is a rationalist insofar he accepts innate ideas and denies that the mind is at birth a tabula rasa or a blank slate. Isn't that amazing? Which it is. Actually, my mind was a bit of a blank slate after the operations. In terms of Leibniz's classical allegiances, it's interesting to see that they are in the realm of metaphysics. He's often couched his philosophy in Aristotelian and scholastic terms, but in the realm of epistemology. He's often far more openly Platonist, that we're all in the mind of God, at least in terms of the existence of innate ideas. Indeed, in the opening passages of his essays on human understanding, his books lengthily commentary on Locke's essay concerning human understanding, Leibniz explicitly allies himself to Plato in the fundamental question of the origin of ideas. So he would say that Plato would say you have a form and you have a supernatural being before, that you experience the form in its perfect form, and then you recognize the imperfect versions of it. And I'm really struggling to get my mind, you know, here. And this is the entire thing, that a lot of the teaching, in my view, is very one-dimensional, nominative. Leibniz has several straightforwardly metaphysical reasons for denying that the mind could be a tabula rasa. First, and most obvious, since there can be no genuine causal interaction among substances, then there could be no way that all our ideas could come from experience. Indeed, no ideas could, strictly speaking, come from experience. Leibniz will, however, adopt a more liberal understanding of sense experience so that this is not mooted tut court. I don't know what that means, tut court. But, secondly, and rarely marked upon, Leibniz believes that the view of our minds are blank states at birth violates the principle of identity of indiscernibles, PAI. In short, PAI works against qualitatively identical physical atoms and against qualitatively identical because blank souls. So you can't have a blank soul because you can't have something like that. So it would be really interesting to have Schrodinger and have a chat with Leibniz. I don't know. I would believe that Schrodinger would be sufficiently gentle personality to speak with Leibniz. Nothing would upset me more to have someone sort of rouseabout bully like Bohr speak with Leibniz in my theory. In fact, this is your conception of this, trying to do philosophy. You consider the philosophers meeting each other and talking to each other. Okay. Further, in one telling passage, he shows us that metaphysical underpinnings of empiricist view that he finds so objectionable. He writes, "Experience is necessary, I admit, if the soul is given such and such thoughts, and if it needs to take the ideas that are within us. But how could experience and senses provide the ideas? Does the soul have windows? It's similar writings and tablets, or like wax. Clearly, those who take this view of the soul are treating it as fundamentally corporal, which is you're spot on, Leibniz. But it's interesting that he therefore thinks that the mind and body are two independent pendulums which just happen to be swinging the same way. Leibniz found a thesis abhorrent. Throughout his career, Leibniz experienced no doubt that the human mind or soul is essentially immaterial. And Locke's skepticism about the nature of the substance is fundamentally at odds with Locke's most deeply held philosophical commitments. But of course, the consequence is that Leibniz seeks to undermine Locke's position with respect to the origin of the nature of ideas. That the mind, according to Leibniz, must be essentially immaterial has been shown above in the section of metaphysics. But Leibniz does have particular arguments for the mind's immateriality or against its mechanism that concerns the nature of thoughts and ideas. This is his famous metaphor of a mill, which comes forth both in the New Essays and Monadology. So monad is this crazy atom drawn by Pythagoras. I'll draw an atom, and God, we've been stuck into it. According to Leibniz, perceptions cannot be explained in mechanical or materialistic terms. Even if we were to create a machine to which one attributes thought, the presence of perceptions, inspection, and interior of this machine would not show experience of thoughts or perceptions, only motions of various parts. However, well, there's sort of two comments I have here. One is that, as I'm going to do, you can have a PET scan, you can actually scan the brain, actually see the various thoughts, and you can actually create a religious thought with an electromagnetic pulse. How about that? You can create a religious experience by whacking a huge electromagnet into your head. And I actually saw this demonstration of this student and having an electromagnetic fry a brain. The second aspect is that my father, who did theology and was Australia's first computer science, wrote that could computers think. He wrote a theological essay somewhere. So it's in some South Australian journal somewhere, lost in the period, his history of time. But he's wrote a Catholic view, a religious view that computers would not be able to truly think because they couldn't hold a concept, which I now perhaps disagree with. But even with Leibniz accepts the common ways of speaking, that is, as the senses are cautiously responsible for some ideas, he has arguments against the empiricist claim that the senses are the origin of all ideas. According to Leibniz, while the empiricist position can explain the source of contingent truths, it cannot adequately explain the origin and the character of necessary truths. For the senses could never arrive at the universality of necessary truths. For the senses could never arrive at the universality of any necessary truths. They can, at best, provide us with the means of making a relatively strong induction. Rather, it is understanding itself, Leibniz claims, which is the source of such truths and which guarantees their very necessity. While we're not aware of all of our ideas at any time, a fact demonstrated by the function and role of memory, certain ideas and truths are in our minds as disposition or tendencies. This is what is meant by an innate idea or an innate truth. Indeed, Leibniz believes that the mind has, quote, a special affinity for necessary truths. You would think, however, you come across all these crooks. I don't know why. I think I'd say or 25% of the people I've come across are absolute crooks. Indeed, Leibniz believes that the mind has... On the subject, Leibniz uses a distinctive metaphor. A piece of marble has veins that indicate or are disposed to indicate shapes to a skillful sculptor can discover and exploit. Similarly, this is interesting, there is a disposition or aptitude a preformation which terms our soul and brings it about the necessary truths derivable from it. Well, I think I wouldn't disagree with him. I'd say that this is my experience. I sort of create things with no premeditation. They sort of just come out of the stuff. I program, and it's evident that a couple of weeks before I have actually done these things unknowingly, which set up for the next bit of programming. I've got no idea how it happens. 6.4, apparition, apperception, memory and reason. The hierarchy of monads mentioned above, so monads are these, well, I hope you understand Pythagoras. A monad is a single conceptual thought, idea. It's, but Pythagoras is still dot in the sand. In his theory of monads, he came up with binary arithmetics, which is the basis. This is Leibniz, who you're poo-pooing at the moment. He came up with the binary maths of a digital age. So he's a very important person. But, you know, what exactly is a monad? It's a monad, it's sort of a group of concepts which surround an idea. Just nothing actually is real. A hierarchy of monads mentioned above is a corollary of Leibniz's epistemology. Monads are more or less perfectly depending on the clarity of their perceptions, and a monad is dominant over others when one contains the reasons or happens in another. This is really a monad's like a thought, I suppose. But yeah, but some monads can also rise to the level of souls when, for example, they experience sensations, that is, when their perceptions are very distinct and accompanied by memory. This position is occupied by animals. Furthermore, the souls are sometimes also in the position of engaging in apperception, that is, to reflect on the inner states of their perceptions. Okay, so that's metacognition. And as Leibniz tells us in The Principle of Nature and Grace, quote, it's good to distinguish between perception, which is an internal state of a monad representing external things, and apperception, or consciousness, which is reflective knowledge of its internal state, something not given to all souls, nor all times given to a soul. The point that Leibniz wants to make clearly, an anti-Cartesian one. Okay. It's not the case animals lack souls, and are merely machines. Okay. Which is really interesting. I must admit, I'll have to reread Descartes on that one. But he did say that animals were just machines. There is a continuum here from God, angels, human beings, through the animals, to stones and dull monads, which underline the muck and grime of the world. So this is the medieval ladder of grace, which I'm very lucky. I had a Jesuit education. This old Jesuit would draw the ladder of grace up on the board, and there's got up here. But it's also really interesting, the ladder of grace, where Thomas Aquinas said, took the nine ranks of angels and broke them into choirs. You know how we have this choirs of angels? It's, wow. I have to go back and reread that and re-understand it. Okay. And it's continuing. It's not solely understood in terms of comparative clarity of the mind's perceptions, but also in terms of kinds of mental activity possible for a particular being. Indeed, according to Leibniz, animals operate not as mere automata as they do in Cartesian philosophy, but rather behave fairly sophisticated mental faculty. Even a dog, for example, is capable, by virtue of its memory, of having perception of prior perception, which is memory. That's why a dog runs away from a stick, which he has been beaten, because his memory represents him the pain which the stick causes him. While this resembles reasoning, it's not the kind of reasoning that humans are beings are capable of. For the mental processes of a dog are founded in memory of facts or effects, and not the knowledges of causes, Ibid. At the same time, Leibniz is quick to add that mental activity of the dog is the same as the mental activity of human beings in 3/4 of their actions. But most of us, most of the time, are not actually reasoning about causes to effects. and yet we are different from bees, Leibniz believes. Some creatures are capable of knowing the necessary and essential truths of logic and mathematics, and an a priori truth, the cause and effect, and they, quote, are, this is a quote, and they, quote, are, wait for it, properly called rational animals, and their souls are called minds. As Leibniz says, the souls are capable of performing reflective acts and capable of considering what is called I, substance, soul, and mind, in brief, immaterial things and immaterial truths. And this is what makes us capable of sciences to demonstrate knowledge. What makes us human beings and higher minds especially is the capacity of a perception to formulate a conception of self. Indeed, as we see in this passage, Leibniz suggests that rationality itself follows from the capacity of reflection. We begin with the conception of self. We move from the point of thinking, of being, of substance, of God, and we become aware as well of the internal necessary truths. Rationality, however, is really the only ability to form inducible connections of ideas and follow them to their infallible consequences. In other words, animals and most human beings most of the time are purely empiricists. A rational person, however, is one that can engage in genuine a priori reasoning, moving from knowledge of a true cause via deduction to necessary effects. Well, this has got a lot of really interesting stuff in it, where they show animals mirrors and do they actually recognize themselves or conceptualize themselves as different. And of course, I've forgotten the name of it. It's Piaget's levels of cognition, self-cognition, and whether you're concrete, functional, and all this type of stuff. But I think this is really interesting because, say, Einstein is the rationalist. So Einstein is definitely in the rational camp, but he was able to connect across to the empiricists with thought experiments. But he came up with the thought experiments is not through experiments. It's the most genius thing. Einstein's a real genius. 6.5, Petit's perceptions. One of the fundamental theses of Leibniz's philosophy is that each substance expresses the entire universe. Wacko. That would mean that each substance has so much energy and it would cause a big bang, which is, you know, most amazing. In order to incorporate this into his general epistemology, the philosophy of the mind, Leibniz develops his account of Petit's perceptions, or minute perceptions, mentioned briefly in this section to pre-establish harmony, and pre-establish harmony. As he puts it into practice, as he puts in the preface to the new essays, quote, at every moment there is an infinity of perceptions unaccompanied by awareness or reflection, that is, of alterations in the soul itself, of which we are aware because these impressions are either too minute or too numerous or too unvarying, so they are not sufficiently distinctive in their own. In other words, everything that takes place in the universe really, as it expresses itself by finite mind, but the infinite perception present in the mind, from the butterfly's flight in the Amazonian jungle to the penguins waddling in the Antarctic, usually too minute, too indistinct to outweigh, for example, the appearance on this computer screen, or a feeling of hunger, of this computer screen, or feeling of hunger. I find this is interesting. Is he having a tilt at statistical mechanics? Indeed, this infinity of perceptions is likened by Leibniz to the roar of a sea. To hear the noise as we do, Leibniz says, we must hear the parts that make the whole, as is the noise of each wave. Through each of those little noises makes itself known only when combined and confused with all others, and would not be noticed if the wave was were by itself. The infinity of perceptions exceptions is then simply epistemological white noise. It's like, what the heck is using physics? Even this person's using physics to explain it. Leibniz, for example, and the wave is white noise. Okay. Leibniz, the simplicity and unity of the mind still allows for multiplicity of perceptions and appetitions. Or that's self-reflections. The multiplicity, however, should only be interpreted as diachronos, which is of different times. But also synchronous of the same times. That is, the mind, despite its simplicity and unity, has within it, at any time, an infinity of different petite perceptions. A human being, in awake state, is conscious of particular perceptions, but never all. And here we see that Leibniz's doctrine is important in far that it offers contrast with Cartesian theory of mind, which is really interesting. That is an interesting aspect. Because the mind is something which is really abused at school. He said that schools and society teach you zero parity of reason. I couldn't agree with Descartes. There's something really beautiful about the way Descartes writes. According to Leibniz, the mind is always active, for there's always perceptions present, even if those perceptions are minute and do not rise to such a level that we cognitize them. Thus, even in deep, dreamless sleep, the mind is active. Perceptions are in the mind. Moreover, if Descartes really did advocate the perfect transparency of the mind, then it should be clear that Leibniz allow for a subtler picture of mental contents, where there are many things in the mind that are confused and minute and which do not always have a complete access, which is such a welcome thing. So you can see that they've taken the worst of Leibniz and the worst of Descartes, and that's what they're giving out to people. 6.6, the extent of human knowledge. Leibniz, however, does not simply disagree with Locke about the nature of the mind and the possibility of innate ideas. It's also Leibniz's contention that human beings are capable of knowledge in a way that Locke had clearly denied. As shown above, Leibniz is convinced that our knowledge of necessary truths has a completely different foundation from that of which Locke argues. Similarly, Leibniz holds that we can have general knowledge of real essences of things, something called in question of Locke. After all, Locke had argued that we ought to admit that the essence is really just a word that we use to describe nominal essence, which again we teach, you know, is that a bat, is that a ball, is that a car, a set of sortal concepts based on sensible quantities. We ought not to act as if essence means anything about real or inner constitution of a thing, for we will remain ignorant of that. Leibniz, however, holds that we can know certain things about individuals, but also about their species and genera. In book 4 of the New Essays, in which Philaethes, a Locke character, gives his critique of possibility of a certain knowledge about substances qua, natural kinds. Theophilus says, now this is interesting because this is the same methodology that Galileo used, and I don't know whether Galileo was alive at the time. Galileo would have just died at the time of Leibniz, but Galileo also used these things, and this is a very ancient way of making an argument. You actually talk about these characters and get these characters talking against each other. Now, who had this? I've got to really think about who uses this character. This is a fundamental technique which you wouldn't use nowadays. It would be, you'd just get lampooned, because you don't need to use it nowadays because it's all by references and citations. It's really interesting that this method of writing has gone, yet it is possibly a powerful method. Let me tell you, Leibniz says, let me tell you that there are, for example, hundreds of truths that we can be certain of concerning gold, i.e. the body's use in its essence reveals itself through the greatest weight known here on earth. nor through the greatest ductility or by other marks. For we can say that the body with the greatest known ductility is also the heaviest of all known bodies. Well, there you go, the periodic table comes in. Wacko, I love chemistry coming in, and this is really true, that you've got the empirical methods, but at the end of it, we're bolting on this rational superstructure. Earlier in New Essays, a nominal superstructure. It's sort of like a combination between Locke and Leibniz. Earlier in New Essays, Leibniz had said, the essence is fundamentally nothing but the possibility of a thing under consideration, and essences are everlasting because they only concern possibilities. It would seem that Leibniz has something like the following in mind. Experience informs us of a certain consistent set of sensible properties in, for example, gold. That is, a certain set of properties is compossible. Is that word, compossible. And more importantly, we ought to be able to assert in certainty that if some object has a great ductility, then it also has the greatest weight. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm not going to be able to survive reading through the seventh thing, which is philosophical theology. Thanks a lot for listening.
Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.